session number 12911, reel 2.
Canon Rossi, reel 2. You were just saying you went around the room.
Went around the room from table to table. At each table was an officer with soldiers. And each one had to ask different questions. Something about details, something about what we're doing, something what we've been doing. And one, they had also some of our personal belonging. And I remember well, at one table I was there, they had my prayer book, the breviary, which at that time was in Latin. And the officer said to me, "What's this?" I said, "Prayer book." "I can't make them out." I said, "Well, I know, sir, you can't make it out. It's Latin." "Well, you cannot have it." I said, "Thank you very much. That's still me reciting my breviary every day, because I'm bound by the priest to say breviary." But I can't remember about the rosary. Somebody mentioned to me the rosary, but I can't remember. I don't like to say anything. But I know that after we finished the tour, went back to the door and we found the clothes there. I'd been searched completely. But dress up again, I went out in the night carrying our suitcase, which also had been searched completely. I entered this building, complete darkness. A sergeant at the head, now a line of about 17 or 18 men, a sergeant at the head with a torch because of the blackout. And we all behind it. We couldn't see where we were going. And all we could find is this. The pavement was very uneven. Now and then somebody stumbled and fell on one thing or another. "Hey, Sarge, moment. What's wrong? Somebody has fallen. Somebody disappeared. Somebody." Then, soon in the morning, we realized what happened. When we got there, we're told to just lie down in this camp bed, you know, canvas, just simple canvas and a blanket. That was all we're given. I remember during the night, there was a commotion, and I don't know what was wrong. I realized that there was a glass roof. A number of the panes were missing, and people were getting wet because it was raining. So I had to shift the bed to a dry corner. And then in the morning they realized where we were, in a disused cotton mill. And of course there were all holes in the ground where the machinery had been moved out. And that's where we're following the previous night. And then it was all glass broken and everything. And they told us to go into the kitchen to cook. I never see anything like it. It was a mess, complete mess. Grease, dirt all over the place. We managed to make some tea and some porridge, I think it was, and managed to eat some. But we're completely lost. We didn't know what was happening. Nobody knew. And went back to the room where we had our canvas bed. And sitting there when the major came in and gave us a real dusting up. "Stand up. You're not allowed to sit during the day." Well, we're nowhere to go. Could only walk around the room. We're not allowed to sit on a bed. What to do? So we just stood and watched ourselves and doing nothing. And they began to settle down a bit. I mean, I think we got over the shock. We began to talk to each other and who you are, what you are, and one thing or another. And then slowly we got going. In the meantime, more and more internees began to arrive. And that's where I began to feel my responsibility to them, because they were all looking at me all the time. And that's where I did also my first job, cleaning the dining room. We had to go down to our knees and clean the whole thing completely, because there were inches of dirt on the floor, and we couldn't eat on it. I mean, it was revolting. So we scrubbed completely the floor, scraped and scrubbed and everything. And this one was such a heap of rubbish, as I mentioned before, outside the camp. And
were you given any cleaning materials?
It was scrapes. No, but we helped ourselves with anything we could get. We had something else. I can't remember. It was a thing of spades or something like that. But we asked the soldier to give us something. It's only after I finished the job, the commandant, see, I had everybody in a line. They all moved forward inch by inch in a huge room. And the commandant came along and he asked me, he said, "Who did all this?" I said, "We did, sir." "Oh." He couldn't believe himself that he could see the stone floor clean. So we were able to eat at least in comfort, without all the smell of the grease and all that, because there were also animals, I think, around the place, rats and things like that. I mean, it was rather not very salubrious, I would say. But I said, we adapted ourselves very soon. That's one thing that did surprise me, how quickly the men adapted themselves. Although, I say this, they were very, very worried about their families. See, from where we were in Bury, we could see the German bombing Manchester. And they had their own families round about there. And they were wondering what was happening. For 15 days, we were not allowed to speak to anyone, communicate with anyone. So these men were tense, so we organized ourselves, myself and another four or five men, like lawyer, people like that, kind of a board we formed, and people came up to us for complaints and what they want to know. We couldn't do a great deal about it, but it gave them a chance to pour all their worries out, and that was a great help to them.
So for 15 days, they weren't allowed to exchange letters?
Yeah, nothing. We couldn't even get news for anyone. All we could get, new people coming in all the time into the camp, reached about, I think, 800, 850, something like that.
What kind of people were there from the political point of view? Was there any political danger from them?
None whatever. Was every shade. I mentioned the little book I have. one, you know yourself, the people laughed and joked about, but the question was, these men have nothing to do. So all that to do, subject conversation was religion, sport, and also a bit of politics, although it was not, I would say, the principal one. So I heard them discussing and talking. So what we did was we put up a few stones in the middle of the space in front of the camp, and we said, anyone who wants to say anything, stand up there and speak out. So here it was. Everybody was going up, and there were some, I'll say, pro-fascist, some against the fascist, some were for the king, some were against the king, some were socialist, some were this, some were that. But there was no definite line. You can see the variety, and everybody cheered away, you know, everybody was cheered. I mean, everybody considered it a joke.
Something like Hyde Park Corner.
Yes. I mean, it's in a pastime to them. I said the other day, actually, the one figure I never forget. The last one was a fellow anarchist. And the lovely silvery hair, long at the back, you know. And he stood there and he was, inveighing against all kind of power and against this and against that. But everybody cheered away, and now was the end of it. Everybody had a say. But there was no question of any danger. Because the men who were there were all ice cream, fish and chips. There were a few professional people. But the people who were really involved with anything, they left before. Because I remember I was offered myself a passage, an ambassadorship. I think it was Bastianini, the ambassador at that time. And the Archbishop McIntosh said, if you want to go back to Italy, that's before war broke out. You see, if you want to go back to Italy, this is the last opportunity. The ship is leaving with the ambassador. There was when people who were actually involved in anything, they were away.
What might they have been involved in?
I mean, involved in, say, some of the party activity, organizing party, not organizing against Britain, because they wouldn't get any of the Italian here. There was not the slightest intention of doing any harm to anyone. All the people I met there, from the top to the bottom, they're nothing against Britain or Scotland or anybody like that. All they were interested was their work. Also, all they were interested in the family and the work. They left Italy because they had no work. They left Italy for the sake of the family, not because of political things. Down in England, I don't know, there may have been some other political movement, I don't know. I can't speak for London. I can only speak for the men who were with me and the people I met later on. But from what I met, I can say definitely there was no danger whatever.
Were the men in Worth Mill friendly towards each other, or was there any quarrelling?
No quarrelling, but actually they helped each other quite a bit in the camp. There was no, you know, in Italy there's usually a division between north and south, you know, and all this kind of contrast. I never experienced that in the camp. They were all quite friendly. They joked about. I mean, I say this, people hardly believe it, the people, that men in that situation had the courage to joke about the whole thing. Pulling each other's leg. You know, it's all kind of thing was going on.
You said that they were held incommunicado for 15 days.
Yes.
What happened after 15 days?
After 15 days, we were allowed one sheet of paper per day. No, per day, sorry, per week. One sheet of paper per week. It was a glossy white paper. And we could write something in it to be left open. And the material was such that if you had any score or change, it was quite evident. Was a glossy type, you know, and it was very easily damaged, matter of fact, at the top. So we had to be very careful in what they write. That, and then we had to give it open to the officer, and they're supposed to send. Now, how many of these letters did arrive, I don't know. But I know one thing. Not a single one of the ones I did write reached Glasgow. Because the Archbishop didn't know where I was. My friends didn't know where I was. And I don't think even the government knew where I was. Because there was a request on the Vatican radio later on. I was among the missing persons in Britain.
So you wrote several letters?
Eh?
You wrote several letters.
Well, once a week. We had all that we had, one a week. About three or four weeks I was there. I mean, what was it, they were right. But never anyone got a letter. So I don't know what happened to the letter.
But the letters of other internees did reach that?
I don't know. I couldn't say that.
Well, letters coming into you were letters.
Not at that time, no. Sooner, later on, experienced. And see, people didn't know where I was. If people got any letter, I don't know. They might have got some message or another. I'm not sure, but the time I was there was the beginning. And the beginning was complete confusion. There was no question about it. It's just chaos. I don't know if they kept kind of record or anything going on.
Did anybody try to escape? Anybody try to escape?
Not in our camp. That's one thing I don't say boast about, but I'm glad to say that with our support, particularly the priest and other, we managed to get these men up in the spirit. Busy the whole day. The result was they didn't even think of escaping or another camp, I believe it was some attempt suicide. But not in our camp like that. They just took for granted, well, okay, that's happened to us and that's the end of it. But there was no question of anybody escaping.
Did you warn them against escaping?
No, we didn't need to. They knew themselves. I mean, as I said, we didn't. All we did was to keep them interest by organizing something, by getting something going, by doing something for them. For example, one day I remember they were standing around and they were in each other's road. So I said to the commandant, I said, could I have a football? There was a football field, not a football, a field, an empty field beside us. So I said to him, I said, can we get them out a wee bit? So he relented. He put sentry around the perimeter, all with a bennet and everything, you know. That's where they really felt criminal, the whole thing. But I threw the ball in the middle of the field. You never see anything like it. About must have been 150 men kicking the ball every direction, you know. Some of them rather portly men, you know. But they're all enjoying themselves, having great fun, you know. That was all.
Did conditions at Worth Mill improve at all?
Not a great deal. We managed to clean up a little. But I say this, there is a book published, probably you have seen it, The Star of Shame. Now, the writer there says that the Red Cross came to the camp and found the camp in a terrible condition. Now, the Red Cross came after we cleaned it. When the German were in, the Italian already left. When the Red Cross came, the one representative came. He saw the camp after all the Italian had left. And I was the only one left because of circumstances, left in the office. But he said it was in a terrible condition. So you can imagine what had been before.
Were there taps and lavatories and so on?
Well, beginning, the sanitary conditions were nearly impossible. There were very, very few WC. You had to perhaps queue for about an hour and a half, maybe more, before you got near the WC. And it got so bad that the number increased that we asked the officer to do something about. So they managed to put a number of pails around the place where people could use it. They put some kind of canvas around, canvas which, I must say, did not last very long, because what the men did was they cut the canvas to make a pillow. See, we are no pillows. With only a bare canvas bed, with no pillow or anything. So to have a head rest or some kind or another, they cut pieces of canvas, they stuffed up with grass or whatever they could, and made a kind of pillow, something like that. But that was all. As far as washing was very, very poor too. You had to queue up. I mean, there was no question of a bath or a shower or anything, no, nothing of that kind. I mean, you couldn't even dream of it. Do a bit of washing as best you can.
And the food you were issued with?
Food, we were fortunate in so far that we had in a camp nearly the whole staff of the Piccadilly and Savoy Hotel. And they did marvels with the food, with the worst of things, they could make anything. Could flavour it, could do this, could do that. There was one of them, I was quite friendly with him actually, Bolognini. He was a pastry cook. And he had done the cakes for the coronation dinner. I used to say to me, look here, father. I fed them, gave me all the cakes, and that's where I landed. But they joked about it. And the thing, they organised themselves. The thing was, the chef, at least the head men in the staff of the hotel, they took over. And they ordered their men what they had to do. You do look after the soup, you look after the vegetable, you look after. And the whole thing was organized like an hotel, a staff. Beautifully organized. I remember the man, I think his name was Milani, I can't remember his name well. He was like a general in the middle of this huge kitchen with pipe, giving order around the place, you know. And it was marvelous to watch. And everybody did what he said. There was not a single one resented or objected.
What was the condition of the health of the internees at the time?
By the grace of God, we're all quite wealthy, healthy. I must say, there was no real danger of infection or anything. They seemed to be quite good. I don't say they prosper in it, but I mean, they seemed to survive and they seemed to be looking after themselves quite well.
How were the guards behaving towards you?
The guard, at the beginning, were rather uneasy. You know, first of all, I say this, most of the guards were very young people who just conscript, or men who were not really fit for a front line. The sort was a kind of mixture of it. And at the beginning, we were rather tense over the whole thing. They didn't know who we were dealing with. So perhaps some of them were under the impression we're dealing with dangerous people. You see? So I don't know. I mean, but they were rather stiff towards us. It's only later on they began to relax. But the first few weeks, they were really very, very stiff. No, they don't know themselves. But I remember to check once or twice the internee, because they were inclined to tease them. You know, you could see them that were uncomfortable, you see. And as they stood outside the barbed wire, the internee might stand inside and say, here, you know, think the crease of the trousers there not very straight? So we bit off the plum. Another fellow coming along, no, I think it's the beret that you think of it. And they were all joking about it, you know. And the poor guard felt very uncomfortable, the whole thing. But after the Italian left, I remember I was kept back because there was an inquiry from Archbishop McIntosh, who made a request at the Home Office to send me home, because he required me in Glasgow. But that was when the second ship left for Canada. See, first of all, the Arandora Star left. I volunteered for that, and I was turned down because I had to go with the second ship. I think it was the Ettrick. And when I was leaving the camp with the second ship, I was called out. My number was called. See, we're all known by numbers.
What would you remember?
I can't remember. Oh, good heavens. I stood out. They all left. And I was left behind. I didn't know why or what. Nobody explained anything. Told to go into the office. I went to the office. It was a big, huge room where I'd been examined the first time when I arrived. And told at the stand at the desk there. There was a canvas bed behind and a huge desk in front of me. And I had to deal with correspondence because there were two officers, interpreters. Well, I'm afraid their Italian were rather very limited. They learned a little Italian during the First World War, now in 1418, because they were with British soldiers in Italy. But you can imagine their knowledge of Italian, rather limited. So they passed on to me any Italian documents, letters or anything like that, and I had to translate it for them and give it back to them. So I was this big, huge table with all kind of paper on top, and behind me was a huge bookcase with letter, with envelopes, big envelopes, each one containing passport, letter or personal effect of internees. And I was in charge of it when they asked for anything, to look for it and give it out, and to make a selection at the end when the people were drowned in Arandora Star. They gave me the list of the people who thought to survive and missing, so I had to make a selection of the whole thing. But I was in this room for a couple of weeks, maybe more.
And then what?
And then after that, in the meantime, there have been German in a camp where I've been, you know, in a old cotton mill. I was alone in Italian. And the mother of father is quite funny because the sergeant in charge got fed up and used to say to me, "You phone the home office." And I had to report every night, what do you call it, Whitehall 1212, am I right?
Yes, New Scotland Yard.
Yes, Whitehall 1212, Italian internee number 1. I had to do that myself because they couldn't be bothered with it. But the strange thing, I was left in the office and they seemed to trust me completely because everything was there. I was left all alone the whole night.
So you weren't mixing with the Germans?
No.
You were just separate?
Eh?
You were just separate from them?
Yeah, I stayed in that room all the time. All the time. I was mixed with the German later on. When I left Worth Mill Camp and I went to Whitchurch, and then I mixed with the German there. I found that the whole camp were Germans. Hungarian, German, Austrian, Czech, all kind of people there were. And they were in four different sections. One section was a very reserved one, and I found they were all survivors of the Arandora Star, German and Italian. We were not allowed to communicate with them, but as usual, you find a way if you want it. So I did communicate.